every weekday morning between 8:10 and 9 o'clock. Welcome to Morning Show Saturday, a relatively new addition to our Saturday morning programming in which we replay excerpts from memorable morning shows that have aired over the previous several weeks. On today's program, excerpts from three different interviews intersecting with the issues of race and racism. We begin with David Marinus and his extraordinary book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe, of course, was one of the great athletes of the late 19th and early 20th century. But the fact that he was a Native American meant that his path was difficult, and there were many doors that were closed to him, drop against which though. But you write, but long before that, he followed this path between divided worlds, Indian and white.
Well, at a fairly early age, he was sent to these Indian boarding schools, which he really did not like, and he ran away from them a few times. First to the Sac and Fox School in Oklahoma, then to the Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas, and finally to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. And all of them were trying to sort of inculcate him into a white way of life. Jim Thorpe, throughout his life, loved, you know, the life of the Native American, of living on the land and hunting and fishing. He said, he was great at many sports, but he said his favorite was hunting and fishing. And so, in so many ways, he was caught between those two worlds, as were thousands and thousands of young Native Americans in that era. Hmm.
You've already touched on this Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which Jim Thorpe attended. And although in so many respects it was built on attitudes that now we just, most of us would find completely repugnant, oddly enough, Jim Thorpe, this process of assimilation that was present from the moment they would step onto that campus. Explain what kind of an education was given to these young people, and in particular, this intriguing split of the typical day of 4 hours of this and 4 hours of this and 4 hours.
Competed against the great colleges of that era, against Yale and Penn and Princeton and Harvard and Army and Syracuse. But it was not a college, up to 25. All of them there learning different trades and getting some sort of liberal arts education and business school education. And to get back to your original point, the reason Jim Thorpe thought it was among the best periods of his life is because it was his most successful period. As the All-American football player, as the winner of the gold medals in Stockholm. All of that happened during the period when he was at Carlisle. He also met his first wife there. And many of the Native Americans, not just the successful athletes, but many others, figured out how to survive there. As much as the effort was to completely acculturate and assimilate them and rid them of their heritage, the Native Americans, all of them did, and many of them actually died there. There's a haunting Indian student cemetery that still exists on that land, which is now part of the Army War College, with 186 gravestones. It's very haunting to go look at that. But in any case, Thorpe figured out how to survive. He was a terrific athlete. He was the most successful athlete of that era at the Carlisle School. So one can understand sort of the contradictions of a place that is, in one sense, dehumanizing and also offering opportunities to people in other ways. And that was the case with that school.
One in five. That is one in five. And perhaps it was even worse than that, but at least one in five Carlisle students ultimately perished before, in a sense, they wanted to try to help kind of achieve a break between these students and where they had come from. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. Yes, you do. The founder of the school, Richard Henry Pratt, who had the motto, Kill the Indian, Save the Man, essentially, said that he would consider it a failure if any of his students went back to the reservations. That's a part of the entire effort to assimilate them into white society and break up the Indian culture. So it was done in two ways. The one way was through those boarding schools. The other way was literally by taking away the communal land of reservations. Thorpe was born in 1887, the year of what was known as the Dawes Act, which essentially took much of the land of Native Americans and made them private property owners with smaller parcels as opposed to the larger communal property. I mean, the entire Oklahoma land rush, which is fairly well known, going into what was formerly Indian territory, their land. So the whole aspect of the way that the American government dealt with Native Americans was to assimilate them through at boarding schools and through land grabs.
And one of the interesting policies also there was something that you call the outing system, where students would be kind of farmed out to various white homesteads near to Carlisle, in a sense, to experience life and to labor, sometimes mercilessly, endlessly laboring on the farmsteads of whites in and around that area. Another way to, in a sense, introduce them to another world that the folks at Carlisle hoped these students would ultimately gravitate towards. But we need to talk about Jim Thorpe, the athlete, and his extraordinary exploits, particularly on the football field. And one of the key figures there is someone by the name of Pop Warner. Explain the important role that Pop Warner played in Jim Thorpe's life and in his early athletic career.
Pop Warner is one of the icons of American college football, and in fact, youth football leagues are called the Pop Warner leagues even today. He was the inventive, innovative coach of the Carlisle Indian School, both football, during the era of Jim Thorpe. He's the one who sort of found Jim Thorpe, recruited him onto the track and football teams in 1907. And they really rose together to fame, both on the football field and track. Pop is the coach, and Jim is as his star player, to be the coach at Pitt, where he had several undefeated seasons, and then at Stanford. And he became, a Hall of Fame coach. And he was a great coach, but he was...
Right. That's a very, very sad chapter. I'd love to have you, in case any of our listeners have never heard it, one of the most famous stories to emerge from Carlisle, and I can't remember, I think it's at least mostly true, or at least there's a grain of truth in the story of Jim Thorpe and the way in which he initially demonstrated his track prowess there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it gets told in different ways, but essentially... He was not in 1907, the spring of 1907. He was not involved in Carlisle athletics yet, and the track team was practicing. Thorpe was coming off a job working at the school in the afternoon. Saw a bunch of R in the high jump, and Pop Warner heard about that, and the next day called him into his office and put him on the track team, and that was the beginning of their experience together in Thorpe's rise in athletics.
Hmm. David Marinus's book is Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Now we'll hear an excerpt from an interview I recorded with Bernard Woods, author of Inheritance, an Autobiography of Whiteness, in which Bernard Woods describes what it was like to be white in the Deep South and how his experience as a white man changed as he grew into young adulthood and experienced all kinds of remarkable things all across the country. As you chronicle for us what you were like as a young person in kind of these high school years, you are something of a rebel, kind of an outcast, and certainly at odds with the way your folks, especially your mother, wanted you to live. And it's interesting, To be perfectly frank, as I was reading some of this, while it was interesting, I early on kind of also found myself wondering, I wonder what this has to do with whiteness and being white and the author's quest to kind of understand this about himself. And eventually, it makes perfect sense why we hear so much about your various escapades and so on, because in so many instances, what ultimately saves you from what should have been the rightful consequences was the fact that you were white. Explain the way in which your whiteness was time and time again sort of a ticket that released you from the consequences of some of your reckless behavior.
Yeah, it took me a long time to realize that the rebellion of young white men was something built into whiteness, and it always expanded the power of whiteness, whether that was the rape and sexual exploitation of enslaved people or going out to the frontier. And so at every point that I thought I was doing something rebellious against the order of things, I was in some ways expanding it. And it became so clear to me when I tried to find those moments between my self-conception and my reality. This story came back to me where I was driving drunk. I crashed into the car of an older black man. The police officer could tell I was drunk, put me in the back of the police car. And then my grandfather happened upon the scene, talked to the officer for a minute. He not only let me go, but wrote it up so that it would be that the weather caused the wreck and the guy wouldn't be able to sue us if in case he was ever hurt or anything like that. And what struck me with horror was that that logic set up two systems of law, one whereby white people are protected by the law but not bound by it, and the other where people of color were bound by the law but not protected by it. And that logic enacted itself in my own behavior for much of my life, throughout my attempts to rebel against my family or the sort of American way. And it finally comes to head with my friend Chuck, who's with me at the beginning of the book and ends up becoming a Trumpist QAnon type person. And I realized that I had changed, that he was still in doing his, you know, posting for Trump and whatever and trying to cause trouble with the Trumpists was similar to what we were doing with Skate DRT and 1619 Project and stuff, sneaking the book to read it for those sort of misadventures and things. But it also was the only way to really be honest with myself and try to look at myself clearly rather than the mythologies that I'd told about myself all my life, because those mythologies are very similar to the mythologies that we tell about whiteness and about the South and about America.
You know, when you end up kind of traveling the country, settling in different places and meeting all kinds of different people, it's really fascinating the places where you will gain insight. And I think one of the most interesting, the more you are kind of at least adjacent to this particular world, the more you begin to understand the relationship between talking about in terms of white privilege, and in particular, when whites tend to look back at past eras and relationships between blacks and whites, and more specifically between slaves and their slave owners. Explain this unexpected parallel that you saw between what would seem to be two very, very different worlds.
Yeah, and it was really laid out to me as much as me having any insight. The Blake, the woman that I was living with, who was a dancer, told me a story that came up at work one night where one of the white women who worked there said, well, my mom wasn't racist. She was raised by a black woman. And that I'd heard that from my mom many times, who dancer said, your mom is just like the guys who come in here and believe that we love them. And that made me realize that it's not only that those men wanted to see naked bodies. They wanted the fantasy that they were being loved for themselves, not for the power and the money. And that was the same thing in the relationship that my mom had with the woman who helped raise her. And so many of the white Southern people who were raised by people who were working in their homes, people of color working in their homes, they expect that what those people told them were the truth. And the fact that they, believing that it was the truth and believing that they were loved by those they were oppressing, was as important to them, as important to us, as the actual power and oppressing.
Hmm. You write this: I recognized something I'd not noticed before, something about how the strip club worked. The men who went in there weren't paying for a naked body. They were paying for a flattering enslaved. She'd tell me how lucky they were to have been brought to America and how much they loved old Mars. The fantasy of love in this sort of racism is not incidental. It is an essential feature. If we can tell ourselves that the people we oppress love us and are happy about it, then we can justify the oppression. Bernard Woods is the author of Inheritance, an autobiography of whiteness. We finish out with an excerpt from my conversation with John Marshall Fisher, author of 17 and 0, which examines the perfect season of the 1972 Miami Dolphins, a perfect season that played out against a backdrop which the author describes as a setting made for Hollywood.
It really seemed that Miami in some ways was a focal point of so much that was going on in the country. We've talked about how both conventions were there in the summer. Nixon was involved in this. Vietnam War was still raging, and you know, all the protests at the conventions in Miami, and Watergate was getting started. The break-in was that June, and during the football season in the fall, the investigation was just getting going. And even there's a Miami angle, because the burglars were, most of them were from Miami.
Huh.
Carl Bernstein went down to Miami when he and Woodward were starting to investigate this. He was down in Miami in the late summer trying to, you know, get some interviews and get some information about these guys who broke into the Watergate Hotel. So to do in this book is talk about how Miami was such a big part of what was going on that year.
And I really love how at one point you say that this team, that is the Miami Dolphins, reflected the social dichotomy of the times. Yet, unlike the fractious society seeming to unravel around them, this diverse group found a way to meld seamlessly into a team, the perfect team. And of course, a lot of your book is all about that.
Yes, I think a big part of that, the credit for that, goes to Don Shula. You know, I mean, he really was a great coach, and he really was a great, incredible motivator of men. And he came down there, and there was, you know, Miami was a very different place back then. It was, first of all, it was much smaller, which I talk about. You know, it was nothing like the big city it is today. It was a smaller community, and it was the South. You know, it was, and there was a lot of, there was still a lot of segregation even at the end of the '60s. Black players who came down there were not very comfortable a lot of the time, and they could only buy homes in certain areas. They weren't welcome everywhere. And on the team, you know, they were separated. In the locker room, the black guys were on one half and the white guys on the other half, and they roomed only with the same race. And Don Shula came down there, and he immediately integrated the team. He assigned roommates, and they were almost all mixed race, and he insisted the locker room be all mixed. He moved all the lockers around. And then, you know, it's not that he was such a great progressive, political guy. He was sort of middle of the road politically, but I think he was for integration, of course. But he really cared about winning, and he knew that they had to function as a team, and they couldn't be separated like that. So he was amazing, really, at doing that, and he transmitted this desire that he had, this incredible mania for winning, to each of his players.
Right. And in some ways, this forced integration of the Dolphins was, you know, kind of a litmus test for the way in which this kind of really happened, although it's not particularly easy.
The interesting thing, though, that just occurred to me is that, of course, you know, you're in Kenosha and in Wisconsin, and Shula was not the first to do this. You know, Vince Lombardi with the Packers had also worked hard to integrate his team, also for similar reasons, you know, this mania for winning and for making a team. And Marv Fleming, who had played for the Packers.
And a team had to make a really concerted effort to break out of that old habit. And you're right. The Packers, thanks to Vince Lombardi, were one of the very first to do that in a meaningful way. And it happened in the Dolphins. You would call him at one point the league's most heralded coach. I mean, he had already enjoyed some great success with the Baltimore Colts. And yet there was something that left him sort of at the second tier in some respects, and that was the fact that before this 1972 season, he had, in a sense, lost two Super Bowls. So he had this reputation of not being able to win the big game. Tell us more about that and how crucial you think that was, or how important that was to Don Shula himself, that reputation, deserved or not.
No way to overstate how important that was to him. He had become the youngest head coach in the NFL when he became the coach of Baltimore in the mid-60s. And he was a great coach. You know, he was considered the best coach, even though he never quite went all the way. He came very close. He lost some big playoff games in Baltimore, but then he finally took them to the NFL championship in 1968. But the thing was, that was the third year that the NFL champion had to play the AFL champion in what was they were calling the Super Bowl. I mean, it was Super Bowl III. They were still separate leagues, but he was ridiculed by his own owner, and his stock really fell in Baltimore. And the next year they had not a great season. And so he was all ears when Miami called, and you know, Joe Robbie wanted to hire him down in Miami. And so he was kind of happy to leave Baltimore and come down to Miami. He immediately took them, and as you say, he was already at that point the most heralded coach in the league. He really was. And first year in Miami, he took this expansion team to the playoffs, second year to the Super Bowl, but then they had another humiliating loss in Super Bowl VI to Dallas. So now he's this guy who's been the greatest coach and the youngest coach, but he has lost both Super Bowls he's been in, and people were saying he couldn't win the big one. And so he just became obsessed with getting back to the Super Bowl in 1972 and winning it. And you know, Larry Zonka remembered him even saying, "We're going to go out there and we're going to win every game." And he was able, as I've said before, he was able to transmit this to each and every player, and they went along with him for the ride. Mm.
To hear any of these interviews in their entirety, go to our website, WGTD.org, to find the Morning Show archive, or look for the Morning Show podcast, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. I'm Gregory Berg. Thanks for listening.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha's Boys and Girls Club now has online protocol for making automatic monthly donations. The club is a safe haven for kids to have